You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the RSA. I'm Joe Hallgarten. I'm Director of Learning and Development here at the RSA, and I'd like you to welcome all of you to today's special lunchtime talk. It's my great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's special guest speaker, Theodore Zeldin. Theodore has devoted a lifetime to the study of the human experience, who we are and how we live with one another. Among his many awards and honours, he's Commander of the Légion d'Honneur, a Fellow of the British Academy and of the Royal Society of Literature. He holds a CBE and has won the Wolfson Prize, Britain's premier literary award for history. He developed St Antony's College, Oxford, as the university's Centre for International Studies, and he's also founder of the Oxford Muse, a foundation to stimulate courage and invention in personal, professional and cultural life. He has, of course, written numerous acclaimed books, including An Intimate History of Humanity and Conversation. He joins us today to share reflections from his new work, The Hidden Pleasures of Life, in which he argues that both the greatest problems and the greatest opportunities of the 21st century are to be found in our relationships with others. His work resonates hugely with RSA's mission around 21st century enlightenment and is bound to inform our emerging work, which focuses on the power to create in people and communities, but also in terms of my work around learning, around closing the creativity gap in learning. But that's enough about the RSA. Over to you, Theodore. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I've written this book as a result of a lifetime of thinking about how we should live. And I've come to the conclusion that we can no longer live today as we have lived in previous centuries. First of all, because we have created educated people, and some of these educated people, at least, now have different expectations, different kinds of ambitions. They want to discover the world. They're not satisfied just to get a job and sit in front of a computer or a desk for the whole of their lives. And the security is not the ultimate goal. And they have got minds which wish to discover. And I'm writing this I've written this book not in order to tell you what to do, but to describe how I have sought to find a way out of the of what is being offered to people and being offered to young people today. The other great change which makes me say that we now have a different kind of human being is that our population has so exploded that every time the population has exploded throughout history, we have invented new kinds of work in order to absorb the new population. We invented agriculture when there was not enough forest to feed people. We invented industry. We invented the service society. We invented public service. And now there are a billion young people for whom we have to find jobs. And many of these are educated, and you cannot expect them to work for the kind of institutions which exist and which were established at least a century ago. And so we have to invent new kinds of jobs. And this is what makes this century exciting. And we have to, therefore, reinvent a new idea of business, a new idea of work, because work is where we spend most of our time, at least a large proportion of our waking hours. And just to earn a living by working in order to amuse oneself is what the 20th century invented. Entertainment industry to keep you occupied when you come home exhausted. And so I see our goal now as to not to start a revolution, because we can't easily, and revolutions very seldom work, and usually one dictator is replaced by another dictator, and I'm saying we must engage in experiments. The pharmaceutical industry is constantly engaging in experiments to find cures for medicine, for medical problems. Most of those experiments are unsuccessful, but they realize they have to spend money on it. And what I want to do in the future of work is to persuade big organizations to have side by side the main activities, a unit which is allowed to experiment and do things differently. And to have as the goal, the development of the curiosity and the satisfaction of giving people an interesting life. And a life which, and this is where it comes to the essence of what I'm saying. What is an interesting life? What is a worthwhile life? What should you do with your life? Well, the obvious answer is, you know, what is the purpose of life? The purpose of life is to produce life. And that is what most people start by doing. They have children and they look after their children. But they spend only a certain portion, of an increasingly small portion of their time bearing children. And so what should they do if we're going to live 100 years? How should we spend our time? At the moment, we never think of business as being buying and selling of time, which, of course, busyness, that's what it means. How should you spend your time? And my thought is that we should take time as how should we spend 100 years? I see, for in order to do that, we've got to have a different idea of how we should think about the past and how we should think about the present. And you know how Einstein said that time is an illusion, past, present, future is an illusion. And indeed, I think we are sitting here and I look at you and you are not just living in the present. Each one of you has got a mind which is filled, which is like an antique shop, which has got ideas coming from many centuries. Superstitions, ideas which you have picked up in the course of your life. And you are therefore a mixture of the past, present. And with one of the great, very recent discoveries of neuroscience is that in order to be able to think about the future, you need to be aware that ideas about the future are formed in exactly the same place in the brain as your memory. And if you have no memory, you cannot think about the future. So in order to be able to imagine a world which would satisfy us better, you've got to have a larger memory. In the 20th century, we were taught that what matters most is the way you were treated in your infancy, and your memory is focused on your childhood, your infancy, and your thought, you think of yourself as being determined by that. I'm saying that we need to expand our memories and to discover the memories of others and to become aware of all the memories of the whole of human experience. And that is what history is about. Without history, you're aware only of the present. You're a modern person. A modern person says, we've got to do better than the past. Forget the past. We've got to create something new. But you cannot create something new if you don't know what has happened before and you don't know the stupid mistakes and the failures and why things went wrong. And therefore, what I've been moved to do is to say, well, I'm putting aside politics, which is involved, concerned with power, and economics, which is concerned with property, and I am focusing on what goes on inside people's heads. My ambition, therefore, for this century is that we should discover who inhabits the world. We don't know who we are. I hear my sitting in front of you, and this is ridiculous. I don't know who you are. How can I talk to you unless I know what your reactions are and what is going on in your minds as I speak to you? And that is why I would like to talk to you individually. And that is why I see, as the alternative to government decrees and laws and to general principles and the idea of class opinions dominating life, I see the interaction between people as being now the crucial motor of change. And that is why I look at private life. Because in private life, one can really discover, one can really be honest, one can really get to know someone really, really well. And how can we work at that and develop that? So I imagine us rethinking each of the problems, take each of the problems with which we are faced, and see how historical experience of all civilizations can modify the way we behave and our ambitions. And the ambition of just climbing the ladder and fighting over promotion and trying to get more money and so on. These are all things which will continue to exist. But what can we do on the side to get round this? And so in this book, I've taken basic questions and I've looked at individuals in the past who have tackled them. And I point out where I've thought about it and what has gone wrong. Why didn't they get where they wanted to? And I could give you examples of the kind of people. I didn't pick famous people. I just picked anybody who spoke honestly about his own life and what went on in his head. And many people who wondered, have I wasted my life? So I've written a chapter about what is a wasted life. And I found a Chinese man whom nobody has heard of, who was quite successful, and he wrote plays and so on, and he was a civil servant, and he had a decent job. But at the end of it, he said, I've wasted my life. Well, what is a wasted life? And then, you see, by relating his experience to the experience of other people whom he didn't know in other periods of history, or to all the other people who think they have wasted their life, then you can think, what is a wasted life? And a wasted life is one based on ignorance, of ignorance of what other people are doing. I base myself, therefore, on the thought that what characterizes us now is not only our education and our number, but also our isolation. We do not know, I don't know who you are, you don't know most of the world, you've never met most of the world. And I spoke to you just before we came on here, the organizer of this event, and I said, you know the organizer who's just made a little speech, and she's been here for 7 years, and she knows nothing about him, really. So they worked together for 7 years, and they don't know much about each other. And I therefore organize conversations between people who don't know each other. And I've done this in a dozen countries, and I'm amazed by how keen people are to know each other and how hungry they are for to get out, not only hungry for food, not only hungry for money, but hungry for conversation and for understanding of other people. And that is what governments cannot do. Governments can tell you, you know, how much income tax you're going to pay. But when you get a letter from the income tax, it is never signed by a person. It is just income tax. And so you don't see the world. You're living in cloud cuckoo land. So how can you get rid of the illusions you have about yourself? The current view, which we've developed for a long time, is you've got to know yourself. And I think that's impossible. You can have illusions about yourself, but the only way you know yourself is in part by discovering what other people think of you, and then you see, you're not what you appear to be. And people in some way can stimulate you to think harder about yourself. But I, instead of saying know yourself, I say know other people. And that is what, for me, the purpose of life is. You know, Mozart said, the purpose of life is death, which means that we've all got to prepare ourselves for a better life, an afterlife. Each of you have your own ideas about what the purpose of life may be. But for me, the purpose of life is to discover what life is. I want to know who inhabits the world. I want to understand what it means to be human, what are the possibilities, and also the end of it. I want to see what I can give to the world which it hasn't got. And I can only discover what it hasn't got if I talk to everybody and see what is missing. And I've got to give a present at the end of it to thank people for tolerating my presence in this world. And this is, to me, the inevitable consequence of the fact that I've been through an education which has taught me, which has made me think that everything is interesting. And I've discovered this when I encourage people to create self-portraits of themselves. You know, tell me what you think you are. And I do this in a conversation because they need to be stimulated. They don't do it easily. And what is fascinating is the way that some people say, well, I'm not interesting. Nobody cares about me. But they are interesting, and you can show that they're interesting. And I remember doing this with, children, adolescents, in one of the worst schools of Oxford where people are trained to become labourers. And they said, this is the first time anybody has asked our opinion. They were scared to talk about themselves because they thought they'd be laughed at. But when they did, they were amazed that, yes, there's something in them. And it's curiosity which makes this possible. And so instead of power and property, I'm interested in the power of curiosity and what we can do by getting to know each other. And I then apply this to the idea of the couple. At the moment, we are concerned with finding a partner with whom we can live and who understands us. I see that doesn't always work very well, and half of marriages end in divorce, and people still feel that they cannot find the person who's absolutely right for them. Well, I'm interested in developing the idea of the couple to the mind. That is to say, not people with whom you are sexually attracted or whatever, but people who stimulate your ideas, who make you feel more alive. And that is, it is possible to have many such people with whom you are coupled in a way which doesn't restrict you, and whom I call a muse, muse, M-U-S-E. That is to say, they inspire you in some way. And at the end of any conversation with you, I would feel that you have inspired me, you've developed some kind of thought in my head which has not been there before. And so how does one apply this to the fact that we belong to different nations which despise each other or insult each other or whatever, and to different religions which keep itself apart? And since all the wars we have, which cause us so much trouble, are the result of nations and religions fighting, we've got to find some new solution for that. And I can't summarize, I've got very few minutes to talk about it, but I'll just briefly say, well, I'm not interested in what your religion, I don't ask you what is your religion, but I say, how do you apply your religion in practice? What do you do? How do you behave? And then we can talk much more easily, independently of what your metaphysical beliefs may be. And likewise with nations. Nations were invented to produce consensus between a group of people who, in fact, are dissimilar and who have not never met each other. And the conclusion of the many years I spent trying to study France as a specimen, as a sort of guinea pig, to see what humans are like, or some humans, I decided that there were as many minorities in France as there were inhabitants, and it's the same in England. And a nation each one of you creates a nation for yourself, You have your own private nations. As I say, you have met people in different parts of the world with whom you sympathize, whom you understood, and you create your own, I don't know what we call it, we have no name for it, but it's your own family, if you like. And you develop sympathies for, and to be educated, you have to develop sympathies for other civilizations. And so this is by more personal interaction. Because you have to know, you don't say, I love all Icelandic people, because you never met them, first of all, but each Icelandic person is different. But when you meet one Icelandic person, you then understand a bit of what it's like to live in Iceland, and you may say, well, I'll come along and try it out, and so on. And when you meet somebody in a totally different religion, and I'll tell you the story of I once invited an Ayatollah from Iran, one very important Ayatollahs, and he spent an hour insulting us, telling us how the West were the devil, and he went on in a very violent way. And at the end of it, he embraced me, and he said, "I want to come again." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because you listened to me." And that is what people want. They want to be listened to. And none of our institutions allow us to be listened to. That is why in politics, I think liberty, equality, and fraternity are not enough. It's all very well being allowed to say what you like in some countries. But if no one listens, what good is that? What you want is to be understood and appreciated. And our institutions don't allow that. It's no good saying we want equality, because, first of all, we haven't achieved equality, and secondly, because we're all unequal in some ways, and all you poor people who are wearing glasses are unequal to those who don't wear glasses, and we can't hear properly, and we all have faults of different kinds. But what we want, what overcomes our inequality, is not equality of money, but affection. That is to say, you can be loved by somebody despite your faults. And that is what we need. And with fraternity, likewise, it's not enough to get a pension and to be treated as somebody who deserves, who is entitled, who has a right to a pension. You want people to recognize you and to make you feel that you are somebody. In other words, you want to feel that you're alive. And everything that I'm talking about is how you can feel more alive. Are you more than 20% alive at the moment? Can you, without more experience, can you raise yourself to 25%, to 30%, 50%? Because I don't think we'll ever be 100% alive. But that is what I... And finally, I want to say, as I mentioned at the beginning, how you spend your time. And you spend your time at work in order to be allowed to live. But work is not organized to please you. Work is organized for other purposes. And how can we now reinvent work so that it makes the satisfaction of your desire to be fully alive the first priority? Of course, you have to earn, you have to balance your books and all that. And I have tried to do it in a number of industries already. And my book describes this. And what I would like is people to embark on these experiments, because we're not going to change the world straight away. But we can see if enough of us show it can be done this way, it can be done that way. And I'll just give you this one example of what I did. I was invited by the managers, the CEO of IKEA, to talk to their managers. And then they invited me to Sweden to talk to other managers. And then they invited me to India to talk to other managers and their suppliers of cheap goods. And I talked to the managers of those cheap good factories. And then they offered me a IKEA store in which to try out my idea that you could make a superstore into a cultural center. That is to say, when you go into IKEA, you don't speak to anybody. You will never know who made the objects you're buying. Why can't you find out with all this technology? Why can't you see that the lampshade you bought is made by a woman in New Delhi, whose factory I went to see? And why can't you thank her? Why can't you learn something from her and vice versa? Why is this an anonymity? And why can't you get to know the salespeople who have all sorts of interesting... They're salespeople only because they can't get other jobs. Now, I remember how the salesman of office furniture had a master's degree in horticulture. Now, that was an interesting man, but you never find out. You don't see what there is behind this facade. And that is why this book is called The Hidden Pleasures of Life, because all the things that we do not notice, all the things we do not see. And in IKEA, we organized English lessons for immigrants, and they had never spoken to anybody, these immigrants. At last, they could come there as a kind of social club. And there was a fascinating woman who couldn't speak English very well, but her husband had been imprisoned and shot. And she was alone. Very interesting stories. And when we got her conversing with an English person, he said, "I've never experienced anything like this." And at the end of it, they were sort of embracing each other and thanking each other for the chance to get out of their isolation. And we organized music lessons for the children, because children usually come to supermarkets and just don't know what to do with themselves. Why do our commercial activities have to be so isolated? Why does art have to be separated from work? And I think that separation is one of the great tragedies of history. And we can think of ways by which we could all not only bring art into work, but make our own lives into a work of art. And so the art of living, for me, is different from the usual solution which is offered to you, which is, oh, say, calm down, don't be too excited, take a course in yoga or mindfulness, and forget the world and just calm down. And this is the old stoicism. And I think there are more exciting things to do, and I want myself to enjoy what is most unique about humans, which is our ability to think, and our ability to think in unexpected ways. To be human is to be a heretic of nature. Trees don't say, "I'm going to grow a new branch," but humans do. And that is what has made us, that's why you're sitting on chairs now and not living in treetops. And so this is how I see it. And then I say, how should we think about the fact that, in fact, we're going to die? And I think, again, a new knowledge about what dying means. When you look at what goes on inside your body, your cells are dying all the time. And they're dying because when they cease to connect with other cells, and when they're isolated, they are pre-organized to just vanish. And I see that as a metaphor for what we are doing. We die when we no longer connect with others. We die intellectually. We cease to be fertile intellectually. There is sexual fertility, but there's also intellectual fertility. And the people, I don't ask you, therefore, what your age is. I say, how have you lived? And if you are still alive, 20 or 50 or whatever percent, your physical age is not what matters. Age is simply a disguise which conceals the fact of how much you have, what is inside you, and how active you are, how capable you are of interacting with others. And when you cease to do that, you reduce the extent to which you're alive. So this idea that you've got to be young, you know, pretend that you're, you know, try and be young and wear the same clothes as young people. This is all disguise. The whole idea of what old age is needs to be changed. And these ideas are what I... This is how I feel. I'm not telling you, as motivational speakers will tell you, you can have everything you want if you only fulfill the following three steps which will make you happy and rich and famous and everything else that you want to be. First of all, because you don't know what you want. And even if you did know what you want, you might be mistaken. And there are other things you could know if only you knew about them, but you don't know, so you don't want them. So giving you what you want is not my purpose. Expanding your imagination is. And I tell you what I've thought because I hope that will stimulate you to think again. And you then tell me what you think. And that is what we need to know. So I'm now interested in you telling me, and this is the best part of this afternoon, what you think, insofar as you're able in this public situation to speak openly. But since it's all anonymous, nobody knows you, so it doesn't matter.
Thank you, Theodore. That was fascinating and really stimulating. And I promise that Abby and I, who is the organiser, will go for a drink soon and tell each other everything about ourselves. but not now. Now, like many people here, I was very inspired by An Intimate History of Humanity, which I think is over 20 years old now. Is that right? And clearly what you've written now is a very different book, but I'm quite interested in, are there areas where you've really changed your mind about the nature of humanity and human relationships over the last 20 years?
What The Intimate History did was to make me realise that the human condition is a false notion, that our emotions have changed in the past. We have been able to change the way we love, the way we fear, the way we feel loneliness and so on. And by looking at each of these, each of the different emotions which compose humans, I saw, so if we could change them in the past, we can change them in the future. And so now I'm saying, well, what can we change? And so I'm moving into the practical side in the sense that since I've written those books, I've been invited by governments and businesses and so on to advise them on all sorts of subjects, which I know nothing. But I've therefore been able to penetrate right into the heart of government. And I was advisor to a president for 3 years, and I've been invited by, you know, people like BP to advise them on their petrol stations. And each of these things stimulates me and makes me think, you know, why are these people so stuck in the way they exist? And so I've been invited into business schools, and I say, why is business so stuck in its concern for getting higher salaries and making things more efficient? Efficiency was a sort of idea which was invented in the late 19th century to make everybody work harder. And now we're working harder than ever. And you're being pressed. And I was interviewed by the Oxford Times newspaper just a day ago, and they said that they've just sacked 12 sub-editors from the Oxford region who are now all located in Newport. And all the local papers of England, owned by this American company who bought everything, in Newport, they get college graduates, people just out of college, but to whom they pay the minimum wage, and they do the sub-editing. And, of course, they know nothing at all about what goes on in Oxford, and they make a terrific hash of it. And but they have saved the salaries of 12 people. And there used to be 9 photographers, and now there are 3. And so everybody's working harder, and you're being squeezed, and we cannot go on squeezing you forever. And that's known as efficiency. And so how do we reinvent our priorities? What is it that we want? And this is what is happening to me. I'm trying to see how we can get beyond understanding and beyond the waffle about, you know, how you've got to calm down and all the rest of it, to actually do something.
Great. I just want to turn to, you talked a little bit about institutions, and I just want to talk about one particular institution, which is the university, which, as you said before, you've been inside and outside of, yeah. And the RSA is turning our attention to thinking about the role of the university in various ways. And I'm just interested in whether you think universities at the moment are helping young people to respond to the challenges that you pose.
No, I think they do the opposite. Not entirely through their own fault. Universities are places where you get specialised education. You have to choose one subject. You therefore can become a very good chemist, or at least a sort of chemist, inorganic or organic, not both. And you become specialised. And therefore you don't know anything about the world. And universities don't teach you how to live. And my ambition is, if you will kindly find me a somebody who's a bit too rich and doesn't know what to do with his money, to start a new kind of university which says, OK, it's very useful to have this specialised knowledge because it enables one to, you know, to make things. But how can we acquire some sense of what life is about? And that means discovering other occupations, discovering what artists do, discovering what doctors do, discovering what engineers do, spending some time with each one, and this kind of going beyond the old general education, doing something a bit more positive by seeing, mixing action with learning. And so we are in desperate need of something more than universities. Universities were invented a long time ago to train priests and doctors and lawyers. And why can't we invent something better? And the trouble is with wealthy people now, they just give money to have a building named after them, which continues what is already there. And what I reproach philanthropists for is for being AA repairmen. When things break down, you know, when people are starving somewhere, they will help. But they don't say, how can we stop people starving? The idea of philanthropy is that they've got people with money to spare. It doesn't matter if they lose a million. And therefore, they've got to do experiments to see what would happen in a certain part of the world which would change things. And so there is a great future for you if you are able to do something beyond, you know, you're helping academies which change, you know, it's a sort of rethink of the old grammar school and so on. But go beyond that. Do something which doesn't exist and try it out. So I spent all my life in universities, and I managed the thing I'm proudest of in my university career is that I've never been forced to examine in the examinations. And I got out of it, that I used all my skill to get out of that because I could not bear to tell people, you are a second-class person and you are a third-class person. What a way to send people home with a second-class or a third-class degree. And I've never been guilty of that.
Some tactics there. We'll talk about that another time. Let's take some questions from all of you. And if I could start with, I can't see our Twitter person.
Yeah, one question from Twitter. Institutions do not listen and do not allow. Is it because they cannot listen? So they're highlighted in bold. So is it a question of, and can they be designed to listen?
Our brains are so made to reject anything which is unfamiliar to us. We are not born free. We are born with fear of the unfamiliar. And we have a kind of sieve which out of all the perceptions which come into our heads, we accept only those which we can assimilate. And it requires great effort to be able to see the relevance of what people are saying when it doesn't fit in with what we are habituated to. And that is why the capacity to be receptive to others is something you have to work at. And that is why it is not enough to have human rights by law. Freedom involves a skill, involves effort. And that is why, and I have written chapters about what women have tried to do to obtain an equal hearing, and why they have adopted old-fashioned ways of obtaining their ambitions. They've protested and so on, but they still haven't educated men to listen or educated men to talk about the things that they want to talk about.
Thank you. Andrew Armour, I'm a fellow of the RSA and I consult and teach at university. So I'm a great fan of your work on conversation, Theodore, and one of the things that I've noticed is obviously the rise of social media and electronic communication in business and at university as well. Most of the students communicate on mobile phone or on electronic systems like Moodle and social media. What is the impact of that on conversation and the quality of the conversation that people are having?
Great. Yeah. So one on technology, one on art.
Well, one at a time, perhaps.
Yeah, that's fine.
The new technology is very useful, but it also has inconveniences. And indeed, it has produced Twitter, which is a very brief statement. It produces Facebook, a very brief statement. And it seems to me that for a proper conversation, you need time. And you need to engage with people, you know, for 2 hours. You cannot understand something just like that. I mean, I'm not clever enough to understand things just like that. And what is missing is time. And that is why I emphasize that we've got to reconsider how we spend our time. Who was it who was telling me? Somebody was telling me, you were telling me how when you tried to speak to journalists, this is the publicity officer of my publisher. Journalists are busy. They have no time. They have no time to read the books. How can you talk to people who are rushing from one place to another? And you're rushing from one place to another because you're being efficient and you've got to do 7 different things within 1 hour. And you're therefore becoming stupider and stupider. And that is what universities are doing. They're cramming. So we've got to find alternatives. And as for the role of the visual arts, all the arts have as their unique quality the fact that they don't have predictable results. As in business, you have to produce a business plan and you have to have a target and you have to promise to do something. And of course, business plans are just fiction because you never do that, but you've got to have them. Whereas the art takes as its principle that you are inventing as you create and you don't know what will happen. And the result is a surprise to you. And it is a surprise to the person who watches you. And then you have to somehow establish a communication between what you have created and what the audience thinks about it. And these are often two different things. So art is an adventure into the unknown, which is the very opposite of business. And I was talking yesterday with psychiatrists, a whole group of these psychiatrists who were saying they were trying to, they were reflecting on the different kinds of psychiatry, those who believe in giving pills and keeping people in bed who are a bit mad, and those who want to work with them on an equal footing. And they were saying it's no longer possible to engage in this kind of free relationship because the government says this is what you've got to do and you've got to have the following result and you've got to cure people within 70 months and everything is fixed by higher authorities. And we have therefore got ourselves into a jam with institutions which are too distant from our preoccupations. And how we get out of it? We've got to do it ourselves. The institutions will go on doing it, but you've got to do something in private. And that is how change occurs. Because though, you know, you get laws saying this is what is going to happen, in practice people don't obey laws fully. And they change them. And when I was doing my book on the history of French passions, I spent a whole series of time looking at laws and reading a large number of theses which had been written about the application of laws, how laws were applied. No one had ever read these theses. They're all on unbound books, you know, uncut books. And but they all show that laws are never applied as they're intended. It's an illusion that if you pass a law, something will happen. Quite often the opposite happens.
Thanks. Any more questions? Gentleman down here. We'll definitely get to you.
Yeah. Hi there. My name is Joe Heber. I just wonder if there is anything that is pure and uncontaminated, because you mentioned art, and art is a marketplace where the dealers and the galleries and everything, you know, it's a value. It's sort of turned into a kind of stream. Okay.
That's very important. Not only art, religion too, is contaminated by its, you know, religion preaches that you've got to love the poor, and then it makes deals with the rich, and it adopts all sorts of monasteries, become landowners, and leave aside the idea that they're supposed to be poor and help the poor. Art likewise has got contaminated and bought up by business, and Picasso is sold for £100 million. It's lunacy, because it's become art. It becomes a kind of a badge which enables the rich to put pictures on their walls. And, you know, you go to a rich man's house and they say, you know, look, I've got a Murillo on the wall. I've got so-and-so on. Aren't I wonderful? This is one of the very serious problems. How could artists live since they've got to sell their stuff? And that makes me think, and then I've written about that likewise, you know, how would life be different if all of you who live in London are obviously having enormous difficulty in paying the rents that are demanded, in paying the absurd price for travel in London, the cost of clothing and so on. Everything has become so expensive that it has become difficult to live. Well, instead of saying this is inevitable, this is progress, this is the market society, whatever it is, what else can we do? And then we say, well, we've got technology. And instead of technology, inventing robots, which so that not only do we have 7 billion people, but we'll also have 14 billion robots running around the world trying to imitate us. Why can't technology think about the problems that really need to be solved? And how can our basic needs be satisfied in a way which frees us to do the things that we're most capable of doing? And you will say this is utopian. No. No historian can believe in utopia. Utopias always go wrong, always get corrupted. But experiment is possible, because you see that you can expect failure. We know we will fail, but that doesn't matter. We've got to try. And perhaps once in 100, we will succeed. And you know that this electric light bulb was a result of experiments where there were 10,000 failures before that electric light bulb was invented.
let's have the two questions in the middle, and I'll definitely get to you as well afterwards, you and then the person behind you. Thank you.
My name's Tim Waterman. This follows on quite well from the idea of utopia. Ruth Levitas recently published a book called Utopia as Method, where she says it's not a goal, rather it's a way of running through scenarios about what the future might be. So with that in mind, I'm wondering it should be how... when we should do it, and where should it be? Just any first thoughts you might have about those.
Yeah. Well, I once invented a syllabus for what such a university might do, and that involved giving people a chance to look at past experience and to look at different occupations and to discover what life is and where could it be. It could be anywhere where a group of people were willing to do it. And lots of people wrote to me and said they'd like to do it. People stuck in boring jobs. How could they come and spend it? But you've got to finance it. And our system doesn't allow us. And so if we want to, move on to... achieve a bit more of what our curiosity leads us to do, we've got to find people who will do what they did in the 16th century when the rich merchants, wool merchants, established grammar schools. That was a strange thing to do. Let the children of peasants and artisans go and study Latin. And the grammar schools were... wonderful ideas, but somebody had to pay for it. And the question is, what should the surplus wealth... As you know, half the wealth of the world is now owned by 1% of the world's population. It doesn't know what to do with its wealth. Well, will you tell them what to do?
One person behind you.
I'm Tim Johns. A very practical question. My experience of large organisations is that they're very good at understanding transactional cost and very poor at understanding value. So the cost of R&D as opposed to the value of R&D. Did you get any pushback at all from IKEA or people in IKEA for the ideas you were suggesting? I mean, moving from the cost of doing it to the value of doing it.
I don't quite follow your question. Can you clarify it?
All the things you were doing in IKEA and in India cost money. And in large organisations, often people will push back and say, what is the value of what you're doing?
Very interesting. I was indeed once invited to the board meeting of Barclays Bank, and I was making various suggestions. The advantage was that the bosses felt that they were being more accepted by the community, that they weren't being seen as people who just wanted to extract money from them, that they were doing a service to the community beyond selling. And IKEA is a bit strange in being a slightly, optimistic kind of organization. Very interesting one, by the way. And they tried it out, and it did waste some money. Organizations don't want to waste money, but I'm saying that they will not recruit people if they go on as they are. The brightest people are not going to go into big organizations as they have in the past. They don't all want to become bankers. And there is now in the City of London an organization called Escape the City, of people who hate the city and earn lots of money. And there's 100,000 of them now trying to get out of the city, but they can't because they've got their mortgages and they're prisoners. Well, is it what we're proposing to the young, that they should become prisoners?
Thanks. The book has a great vignette about Walmart as well, which I won't ask you to talk about now, but it's really worth a read. Last question, I'm afraid, from
Jennifer Ball, fellow and a teacher and a linguist, so I suppose lateral thinking is what I have to do. But I find what you've said is attractive, and we're here partly because we expected it to be. You began with the biological imperative, and that is very close to greed, which is, I think, the commercial parallel. And you haven't said or mentioned the word greed, and you haven't mentioned the word altruism, but is your thesis not to try to find a balance between the two so that greed is subordinate to altruism? And if so, how on earth are you going to do it?
No, I would not observe. I'm glad you raised this. I think the great problem is not greed or altruism, but fear. We are afraid to do things with which we are not familiar. We're afraid to talk to somebody who might hurt one whom we don't know what response will be. We're afraid to get out of our little niche and speak about things we know nothing about. Fear is what holds us. And my answer to that is the only thing that gets over fear is curiosity. Curiosity is the only thing I know which makes one forget one's fear. And you go into situations which are dangerous because you find it so interesting and you forget that it's dangerous. If you're worried about the danger, you'll never go there. And likewise, if you said to your, you know, to your pupils, if whatever it is, go and do something which you're not qualified for. Go somewhere where no one expects you. Go and talk to people whose language you can't understand. They all say, no, it's dangerous. And I've experienced this in Oxford quite recently, of the students saying that, no, they don't want to talk to people in a different subject because they'd be scared. They might be laughed at. Fear is, and I believe that we are educating people not to be scared. That's my answer.
Wow, that's brilliant and challenging as head of education here. I'll take that one away, definitely. We've run out of time, I'm afraid, but I'd just like to thank all of you for your fantastic questions and for coming, and also thank Theodore as well. Before I do that, I'd just like to say that his new book, The Hidden Pleasures of Life, is available for sale outside, and I'm sure Theodore will be able to sign copies. I've read it. And first, the thing I'd like to say, first of all, it makes me really quite optimistic. There are real grounds for optimism in there. But also, it's got some of the best chapter titles I've ever read. So if nothing else, look at the chapter titles and then think about buying it. I'd like to thank Theodore on behalf of all of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.